My name is Alyssa Liakos, and today is December 12th, 2014. I am interviewing Jane Garcia for Kim Schroeder Oral History Class, LIS 7770. Jane, can you please say and then spell your first and last name?
Yes, my name is Jane C. Garcia.
Okay, and then can you just spell your first and last name, please?
Jane, J-A-N-E, and then the initial is C for Carvajal, and the last name is Garcia, G-A-R-C-I-A.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Jane, can you give me some background of your early life, like where you grew up and where you went to school?
Okay, I was born in Detroit, Southwest Detroit, to be exact. I was baptized at St. Anne's, which is the largest and the oldest Catholic church in the state and in the country in some places. I think it's over 300 years old. I was raised and went to school in Corktown, which is the Holy Trinity area with Father Kern. I got married very young. Let me see, what else would you like to know? I went to Holy Trinity, I went to Franklin, I went to Western.
Oh, okay. And how young were you when you got married?
I was 15.
15?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That is young.
Yeah. Yeah, it was young. The year of 63 was a great year. It was a great year for not only for the country, but also for myself. We walked in August in 63, and, you know, before the Great March. I mean, we did a lot of things because my father was a union person, so we got a lot of things done. I met my husband, and we got married young.
Wow. So what types of union activities did you march in with your dad?
I was the march that they had before they had in Washington. They had a big march in down Woodward, and Holy Trinity was involved because it was a union thing. And that's where, you know, Martin Luther came and actually marched. I was very young. I was only 15.
Mm-hmm.
But it was great because, you know, we redid the march last year, and it was really wonderful to relive it because, you know, when you're 15, you're just marching because you were marching for rights and things like that. You don't know the impact it's going to take years later.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was young.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your family life?
Well, yeah. Let me see. My mother and my father worked at Chrysler. So he was very much, he was a union steward, and my mother was somebody that worked at the restaurant, and when we were older, she worked in the bar because my father and mother separated, but yeah, she worked in all the bars in our communities, and she worked at the restaurant, whether it was the Texas restaurant, which is right across the street from Holy Trinity when we were kids, and she walked across the street because we lived on 6th and Howard at that time.
Okay, and then did you have any children, or?
I had my brothers, all my three brothers with us, and yeah, it was pretty nice. I mean, you know, we didn't think it was hard. We had people that were around us, they had 12 and 14 children, so we were small compared to them.
Oh, wow, yeah.
The Solises, the Navarros, the Solanos, they had 12 and 14 children.
Wow.
And all living at home.
These were families in the neighborhood that you grew up in?
Yeah, they were in the neighborhood. Uh-huh. Father Kern had a lot of community people that, you know, that he would help out a lot of people because, you know, there was no services in those years. You're talking about, you know, 59 to 64. There wasn't a lot of services, you know, for people. So they would mostly go to the church, and mostly they would go to Holy Trinity, you know, to get services, you know?
Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a little bit about living in Southwest Detroit prior to you becoming an activist there?
Well, let me see. Well, I was very young when I got married. I had three children by the time I was 19. I went to beauty school. I went to community college, you know, but my husband was at Wayne State, and he was very much an activist and working with, you know, the Latino en Marcha and the black unions to get attorneys back into the law school because they weren't accessing people. They weren't allowing a lot of that in Wayne State back in the late 60s and early 70s. So there was a lot of marches going on. So I would cook, and we're talking La Raza Unida, you're talking about the farm workers. You know, Cesar Chavez came in to organize the farm workers. There was a lot of students coming in from the University of Michigan. They were organizing social workers. And so they used to come and meet at different houses, and then we would cook for them because they were all students. And that's how we all got involved because, you know, there wasn't a lot of places they could go and meet. And so they would meet at homes, and they met at my in-laws' homes. They met at, you know, at the Farm Workers Union that used to Lakla, and they used to meet at Holy Trinity. They met at Redeemer. So that's how that movement all got started.
Did you ever meet Cesar Chavez yourself?
Oh, yes. No, I actually met him several times. I worked with him back in the late 60s and early 70s, yeah.
Oh, great. Can you tell me a little bit about working with him?
Well, he was organizing the unions back in California for the farm workers, and the issue was that the UAW had a big impact. The UAW helped with the organizing, and there's a library, in fact, University of Michigan has one, and so does the UAW. The UAW has a whole network of things that they help with, you know, because they were helping organize a different union, but they were in helping them organize the farm workers. So they came into Michigan quite a bit. In fact, the young man, I call him young, but he's not young anymore, we're all older, who took over the farm workers is Arturo Rodriguez, and I knew him when he was a student, and he turned up being the son-in-law of Cesar Chavez. So we had a long relationship.
Hmm.
And his daughter right now is at the White House.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What's she doing there?
It's so funny when you think about all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah. Small world.
So we grew up in a world of activism only because there was no other service. Do you understand? It was a need. You know,
right.
It had a lot to do with that kind of need. You know, I went to Wayne County Community College when it was all black. You know, it was all African American. I was the only Hispanic in the club, in the whole room. And because I was picked to be, guess who's coming to dinner? Because I was the only one that was not black.
So it was
a lot of fun. I mean, when you think about it, it was a lot of fun growing up in that era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we grew up with Motown. You know, we walked down, you know, Grand Boulevard. You know, we actually had to see a lot of the singers. You know, I mean, you grew up in that era because it was there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So what types of services were missing from Southwest Detroit at that time?
Services? There was all kinds of services they were missing. There wasn't bilingual services at all. You learned English or you failed.
Mm-hmm.
It was that easy. I can remember up into the late 60s, probably about 67, before the riots, I can remember a lot of the students going into Lausanne, and because they were doing real well, they were asked to join either the military or go to work at Great Lakes or Ford because, you know, they weren't going to graduate. There was no hint that people were going to graduate because, of course, they spoke a different language. So it was real hard for people. And the parents would go to places like Lausanne. They want to push my children out. You know, we want them to graduate. And, you know, people had to go and take a very strong view on how to advocate. Lausanne, Latin Americans for Social and Economic Development, actually filed a lawsuit against the Department of Education because of lack of bilingual services. And they won. You know, so, yeah, they were very, and they filed a lawsuit against the Department of Social Services at the time because there was no bilingual services, so nobody could get food stamps, nobody could get aid to children because they didn't have anybody that could speak the language. And if you couldn't speak the language, you couldn't apply for services. Very much like today, if you don't have a Social Security card, you can't get a food stamp card.
Hmm.
Even though your children are born in the country. So, you know, to some extent, we've come a long way, and yet we've lost some things along the way, especially for immigrants.
Mm-hmm. So were there any particular groups or individuals that were sort of causing problems in the community at that time?
Well, I think the lack of services was a problem, the lack of sensitivity. You know, the state felt that if you, the state meaning the state of Michigan, felt, well, if you were here, you know, you had a thing for yourself, if you couldn't fill out the application, then you couldn't fill out the application. I mean, those were the kind, and so by law, because you made up so much percentage of the population, they should have been hiring people and not discriminating against them because they knew two languages.
Mm-hmm.
So we always had that kind of a battle. Unfortunately, here we are 40 years later, 40, 50 years later, and all the people that we struggled so hard to get into the system are no longer there because they retired, and no one builds the backlog. No one is doing that anymore, you know.
Hmm.
It's not their issue. You know what I'm saying? It's like, fend for yourself.
Yeah, why do you think that is, that no one sort of came up?
Well, I think it's the idea that immigrants are aliens from another world, not mm-hmm. from another country. I think it's that deep down, somewhere along the line, that people are different, and because they are different, they're treated differently. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I went to a meeting, I don't know, 5 years ago, and I remember that someone mentioned, and this was a corporation, this was not a community agency, this is a corporation, and they had asked the community agency to come in. And they said, well, we really do want to hire foreign immigrants, like people from Puerto Rico. I had a reminder that Puerto Rico was not a foreign country.
Yeah.
That Puerto Rico was part of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They're not immigrants. And this was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So the lack of that sensitivity or knowledge or culture is just amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
In a country where half the country now are minorities, the insensitivity that still continues, it stuns me.
Yeah. Do you think that there's any immediate solutions for that?
I think dialogue is the immediate solution. Dialogue, the continuation of uncomfortable dialogue, will bring the change.
Mm-hmm. All right.
People don't like to do uncomfortable things.
Yes,
so they stay
true.
Away from them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do not bring the discussion up, you know, then you never have a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't like the solution, you've got to discuss it.
Right.
You know, I grew up from a community. They were Maltese. They were, you know, African Americans. They were Hispanics. They were people from Ireland. They were people from Scotland. I mean, and you communicated because you grew up in this community. There was a real community, and people helped each other. I think that disconnect is what's happening so much, you know, across not only our community but across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that reconnect through agencies help, you know, like, you know. I've been involved with Las Vegas since I was 19 years old. I mean, that's a long time, you know. My mother-in-law and, you know, Juanita Hernandez and people like that from the community that we build on these people, they had the knowledge. Father Kern, who said, you know what, there's not an agency that's filling the needs of people that speak Spanish. It was Spanish-speaking in those years. It wasn't considered Hispanic. Spanish-speaking. So we've gone from Spanish-speaking to Americans, to Hispanics, to Latinos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
they didn't know what to do with people that were another language, right? And
mm-hmm.
so it was interesting to watch the growth. Like when I was a young girl, I went to help at La Fed at 19 to make tamales and raise money and cook and, you know, gather toys for children that didn't have it, you know. And here I am, you know, 50 years later almost, and I'm still doing the same thing.
That's outstanding.
Pardon me?
That's outstanding.
Oh, well, I think it's because I remember somebody said, you love La Fed like you love a member of your family. Well, I grew up with La Fed, so obviously Father Curran was very instrumental in starting this agency. And it was real hard for the community because you had priests and nuns and the UAW and an organization called the United Fund. It ultimately spun off and became United Way, but it was the United Fund, and back in the 60s. And the idea was to help people, right? Not just get them food stamps and not just get them their gas paid and not just to make sure, you know, there wasn't a lot of talk about domestic violence, even though it did exist. There wasn't a lot of talk. You know, the family members didn't come to say that their husbands, you know, beat them up over the weekend because they drank too much. You know, you didn't hear none of that, even though it existed. So the idea was to grow from that kind of an organization that was to help people get their food stamps, pay their bills, you know, find out where they needed to go to services, blah, 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 right? But at the same time, you were struggling because you had people on the board who didn't believe in divorce and definitely didn't want to hear about domestic violence and definitely, you know, didn't want to hear about incest. You know, you had a lot of things that they didn't want to talk about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the organization back in the late 60s, because it started in 65, you know, it was a group of people starting together, and it was founded in 65. It took them 4 years to incorporate, 4 years to become a nonprofit because, you know, some people didn't want the church out of there, some people didn't want the UAW out of there, some people didn't want this, some people didn't want that. But you had to grow and you had to move away because ultimately you had to deal with all the real social issues.
Mm-hmm. And that was,
you know,
United
you
Fund?
Couldn't beat up, you couldn't tell a priest that the wife was beat up and she needed to leave for her own safety. Their issue was to keep that marriage together. So obviously you were going to be coming at odds. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So you had to grow. And so that, and out of Lastair came all the other agencies. You know, Lastair was the founder of a lot of organizations based on the fact that the need was there. They couldn't do everything, and they didn't want to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so today, the Latinos Marcha, Chicana Borinta, and you have it, the Latin Studies at Wayne State, was started at Lastair. And that was to get people into the universities, to keep them into colleges, to give them higher education, to have a network so that you could groom them and hold their hands while they went through this process, because it was a different process for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they did. I mean, that's what we did as an organization, you know. I mean,
and that was that LACED or was that United Fund?
Yeah, that was LACED.
Okay.
That was LACED. I mean, I was just a part of it. I mean, there was other people that were really instrumental. I mean, obviously, Father Kern, who had the vision, even though he was the priest, who had the vision that services were needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he still is spoken very highly in the community, and he's been gone a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so was he kind of like the spearhead of creating?
Yeah, he was the Monsignor at Holy Trinity that everybody went to. He was probably the first social service agency. And, you know, they still have a clinic there. And they still have a legal services there that comes there to get services. So whatever he established stayed. He just created LACED a different, he started LACED a different issue based on the fact that the need was so well. And he wanted it separate from the church.
Mm-hmm.
So he was one of the founders. And that's why you got to give him credit for that, you know. And the UAW, you know, the union people that thought it was real important.
Alrighty. So did the city of Detroit or the state of Michigan, were they doing anything to intervene on behalf of the community at that time?
No. No, they weren't at the time. You know, you got to remember that when you're thinking about the 60s, it was very different in that aspect. It was very white controlled. It was white police officers, white firemen, you know, white administration. You know, their issue was, it wasn't, they couldn't justify the things they were doing with African Americans, and alone with somebody that spoke a different language.
Mm-hmm. It
didn't stop us from us becoming our own leadership. It didn't stop us from becoming activists.
Mm-hmm.
They know you're wrong. That's why I said I'm a great advocate for discussing things when they're uncomfortable, because you can't get a solution if you don't discuss it.
Mm-hmm. So then what effects did the riots have on your community?
Well, you know, it was real interesting that day of the riots, and I can still remember it. We lived on 22nd Street, and we lived under the bridge. And you could imagine living under the bridge and having marshals all over, you know, federal
mm-hmm.
troops, because it was a bridge. So they had to protect that bridge at all costs. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So we could, as we left the house, we had to be very careful because they were tanked right by our house.
Wow.
You know, and that's amazing when you see that when you're, you know, when you're at that age, at 19 years old, and you're finding tanks. And then we had to go to La Stan to make sure that, you know, that nobody broke in. And, you know, and it didn't happen that much right on Burner and all that area. But I think it had a lot to do with the tank. You got to remember, we were right next to the bridge. As you move further, you know, if you move further north, which on Michigan Avenue and Livernois, it wasn't that bad. It really was no burning. But if you moved up to Grand River, then you saw all the, you know, you saw all the destruction. And there was a lot more destruction than people talked about.
Oh, really?
I wasn't that scared, but I'm just saying, I remember the destruction afterwards, you know. But it was very uncomfortable just having all the tanks around. Because you're young and you're thinking, what the hell? You know, there was, you know, you just don't realize the impact because you don't see it all. You just see the aftermath, you know. You got to remember, my girls were like 3 and 4 and a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was more concerned about keeping them safe because I thought, what the heck are these people doing, you know? But the riots changed things, obviously. It changed communication. I think the city wanted to see what they could repair. I think they had good intentions. I don't think the change came about as fast as it should have came, and I don't think it came about as willingly as it should have came. You know, we're talking the riots. We're talking, you know, 5 years later, we had the first African-American mayor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So change came. But it, you know what I'm saying, it just didn't come the way people thought it was going to come. And it was a very uncomfortable time.
Right. What were the expectations that people had that weren't met?
I'm trying to think that, you got to remember you had a white police force, totally.
Mm-hmm.
In a city that was already probably 50% African American, and maybe 5% Hispanic, maybe 3% Hispanic. But, you know, you're not talking about, you had representation. You're not talking about you had acceptability. And I don't know, I never want to say that it was by design. I want to say that it was business as usual. And it came, when the riots came, the solution was to see what they could do about fixing the imbalances of it. But nobody really likes change, so it took many years. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So you saw a lot of African-American police officers, Hispanic police officers, you know?
So,
and to some extent, and you had to live in the city. You had to live in the city. So your citizens was a lot easier to deal with because you had to live where you worked.
Yeah, that makes
sense.
You
don't have that anymore. So you have that disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have that anymore. You don't have to live in the city anymore.
Right.
So that disconnect has happened. Not only for African Americans or Hispanics or the citizens of Detroit. You didn't have that many people, you know, you've had a lot of people leaving, not only African Americans, not only white and Hispanics and African Americans, you had a lot of people leaving.
Mm-hmm.
You had the most people leaving from 1980 to the year 2000. And then 2010, the census will show you that we went from 1 million to 700,000. That wasn't just African American. That wasn't just white. That was African American and Hispanic.
Yeah, so it was across the board that people were.
It happened across the board.
Leaving.
Because people want what they want for their children, and what they want is good education.
Right.
You want, you know, when you're single, and I can see that now, when you're single, you can live anywhere. Because you're single.
Yeah.
But once you have a family, you want them to have good access to good education, you know, and that happens no matter what economic space to come from. No matter whether you're Hispanic, African American, or white, you want your children to have the best education you can provide to them.
And that wasn't being provided at the time for...
It hasn't been provided for several decades.
Right.
What we won in the 60s, what we won in the late 60s, early 70s with bilingual education is totally gone now. They have it, but, you know, bilingual education should be a bridge for people that need it so they can learn the language. It shouldn't go on for 12 years. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of lose a lot of that process, you know. I'm an activist. I'm always going to be an activist. I fight for the issues that I think that impact our community.
Right. And so in terms of your activism, being that, you know, you had a young family at such a young age, and you were involved in unions and you were active in the community, what was your sort of your tipping point that you decided, hey, I need to really, you know, get up and do something about what's going on here?
I think it happened sometime in the early 70s, only because my husband was very involved, and we were both very involved, and by that time we had four children, and he said, you know, honey, we both can't be involved. And he said it real clearly. I'll never forget it. He said, we can't both be involved. If this continues, we're gonna miss something with the children, you know. And I cracked up and I said to him, I said, okay, so then you do it, honey. He said, no, you're more of a vocal person. You do it and I'll be with the kids. I'll do everything, the coaching with the children, the school, the after-school program. I'll do everything there and you do it. And that was a real important time when that happened, you know, because it was a real turning point for, you know, because I was always involved, but I wasn't. You know, I was always involved. You know, we cooked, we raised money. You know, we always did that superficial kind of, like, you know, doing things, cooking, raising money, you know, marching. We always did that.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a real strong view when my husband said to me, you know, you need to do it because you are just more vocal than I am.
Right.
You know, and I said, okay. All right, honey. And so, you know, that's the decision we made, and that's when, you know, I took a strong stroke. I went on the board of directors. I was just cooking before then. I went on the board of directors, and we did a lot of the other strategy meetings, making sure that New Detroit understood. There was an organization that started after the riot, and, you know, we always had to advocate that, you know, it wasn't a black issue only. We had to have Hispanic at the table because we were part of the community. So, you know, those are the roles that we had to take, and that I started taking along with the other people in my community of moving forward, that we needed to be part of the process.
All right, so can you talk about your early years as an activist?
I think the early years was basically, it started off at the, you know, we were always involved, but it started off at Webster School.
Okay.
I was a teacher's aide at the school, and the parents came, Latino parents came, and they didn't speak English. So they had a parents meeting, and we started an organization there because we had a parents meeting, and they told them that they had to leave because if they didn't understand English, then they couldn't be in the meeting.
Wow.
Oh, you know, it was real direct. And we're talking 71. So I said to them, I said, you know, that's totally unfair. And I worked with them for Mr. Lottie. I think I took out the rest of his hair. He just was so upset because I got up and I said, no. You know, he said, well, you work here. I said, yeah, but I'm also a parent. And I do not expect these people not to be treated this way, you know. And so I said, you know, no problem. We'll start our own organization. You won't let us be part of this, and we'll start our own. And, you know, and we'll still make decisions on our impact of our children. And it was the fathers, you know, it was the parents and educators is what it was called, because the teachers that were there, they were Spanish joined. So it was called parents and educators. And what we did is that we told the parents in Spanish, you know, their rights and their accessibility to school board members and things like that. We taught them that they had to stand up for themselves. And we were very proud of that because they became very, very strong in their views, and they would get up and say their views and we would translate it. And the school board actually listened to them, you know. And it was a big change for the parents to come in and feel comfortable. They weren't thrown in a bathroom. I mean, they actually came one time at a meeting and they had a meet in the bathroom.
Wow.
So they actually experienced that real strong, you know, racism. You know, there was no other way to say it. You know, there was no other way to do it. And I remember Mr. Lottie, who was the principal, you know, poor thing, he was suffering a heart attack every time he saw it. He said, you know, you need to start aggravating these parents. I said, I'm not doing anything. They're coming and they're meeting. And they have every right. They have their children here. They pay taxes. You know, so those were our first steps to getting the parents organized. And then, you know, we kept going and it kept growing. And, you know, it was, like I said, it was always, you know, it was always moving because of the injustice to the parents. That was our role there. And then I went on to the board of LaSalle, and I was there involved with them and their actions against State of Michigan for not having bilingual services. So we were always involved in that role, and I say we because there was a lot of people involved. I just happened to be a lot more vocal than the rest of them.
So what other types of programs did you create for the community?
Well, that was a real important one, I thought, because it impacted on the children.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we talked about social workers. We got workers to go into the social services because we met with them, you know, LaSalle as an agency, which was the strongest agency at that time because we were an activist agency. We met with the state of Michigan and proved to them that if they could not provide services, you know, to them, then we would, you know, we would file a claim and a lawsuit against them. And we did. And they settled and instead trained, you know, like 50 across the state and hired Spanish-speaking people. They were qualified. It isn't like they were dropouts. You know, they were college degree people. They were, you know, people that had graduated and, you know, were bilingual, could read and write in both languages. So they were very good people. They were very knowledgeable and very qualified. And so that was a big break-in when we did that. That was a big break because that was the Department of Social Services. And then we were able to do the same thing with DPE, and they were able to do the same thing with Mishkan, and they were able to do. So basically, we proved our point that these were people that were coming in, and they had some problems, and they didn't have anyone that they could listen to their problems because they didn't have bilingual staff. It didn't mean that because they were bilingual, they were less qualified.
Mm-hmm.
So those were the issues that we took on as an agency, and I just happened to be part of that rollout, you know.
Okay. So what was, what do you think throughout the course of your career as an activist, what was the most impactful change that you helped implement in the community?
And what kind of change did you say?
The most impactful?
I think the most impactful was that we did something about 10 years ago when we met with, when the school was taken over by the state. And we met with David Adamatti, who was university at the time. He had just left the university. He just left Wayne State. And we talked to him about having qualified individuals that would become principals. And during that activist and during that time, we turned up with 11 Hispanic bilingual principals that were promoted. That was a real big impact to me. I never forgot that. Because you saw an outcome. You know, you don't always see the outcome of everything else, you know, but you saw this as an outcome. We put them through school. Wayne State was helping. You know, they had to take so many courses and leadership. They don't have to even do that anymore, but at that time they did. And we turned up with 11 administrators at one time. That was quite unique, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just like, it wasn't just Jane, but I'm just saying we were part of that. LaSalle was part of that. And that was a big impact to me.
Yeah, it sends a powerful message.
Right, and so I think those were important. I mean, you got to remember, I was always a little different than the rest of my group. I was the first Hispanic elected as the Hispanic vice chair of the Republican Party. I mean, when I did that, my people had a heart attack. I was always a little different. But, you know, I did that also because I always was more conservative, even though I was very different as far as making sure activism. I was conservative in views on you know, financial and, you know, I wanted to make sure. I remember somebody asked me in Chicago, why would you be a Republican? I said, why not? You know, and they said, well, because, you know, Republicans don't do for people. I do for people, you know, and I'm a Republican.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so it was just like, it was real different for them. And I remember when I won being a vice chair, there were some people in the UAW that quit talking to me.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they actually quit talking to me. But you know what? It was okay. Mm-hmm. Because I did what I thought was important. And when I was a vice chair, I went all the way to the White House fighting for Hispanics.
Yeah, and that's...
So it didn't matter. You know, to me, it's this access. It was always that access.
Right.
You know? I could win over Republicans. It didn't bother me whatsoever, you know? Give me a room, I'll fight my battle, you
know? That's fantastic, it doesn't matter which, you know, political party you're involved with or where you fall in the spectrum.
Oh,
you
yeah.
can still do
and
good.
What somebody said, I remember somebody said when they introduced me in Chicago, they said, Jane's the first Hispanic ever elected in the state party, and in the Republican Party. And somebody said something like, ooh, or something. He said, oh, no. He said, I don't want you to say anything like that against Jane Garcia. You know, Jane Garcia, no matter where she goes, she's always fighting for the people. So it doesn't matter what her political process is. It wouldn't matter what her religion is. It's just who she is. And I thought that was very kind of him. In fact, years later, in 2003, the Hispanic Leadership Conference presented me with the medalla of the Cesar Chavez Medalla for activism.
Hmm.
And that was a great honor because I knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And I had worked with him. And to be even associated with someone that died for his causes was very moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was very moving. In fact, that was the year I met Obama. He was at the head table with us.
That's pretty outstanding.
Yeah, he was running for senator.
Oh.
So it was a long time ago.
Uh-huh. Well, again,
it was a long time ago.
A small world. You had really powerful connections to people.
Well, I think it was real interesting because, like I said, I was, you know, there was a man in our city, a very, very powerful man, and I got to be at the tables with him, with Frank Stella, and, you know, and it was always interesting when I watched him, you know, he was a Catholic, very much the I went to his funeral, and he had three archbishops. I've never had seen three archbishops at a funeral.
Wow.
And I said, my poor Frankie, my love, bought his way to the political party and to God. I mean, they all laughed. I said, well, because I loved him. So, you know, I just genuinely loved him. And that's because I said, I think because of the circles I was in, I had access to a lot of people that could make decisions that impact on our lives.
Mm-hmm.
I started something in 89 with the help of other people, not just Jane Garcia. But I always say that because you cannot be successful by yourself. And I truly believe that in my heart. Yes, I'm a voice, and yes, I'm an activist, but I also have had a lot of support throughout the years, not only from my family, who genuinely have always supported me, and my husband, who always has thought, you know, I could do anything, but also from a lot of friends. And in 1989, I saw something that other people hadn't seen, and I was very angry about, you know, corporate America and what they were doing to people. And in 1989, we had a Bill Beneteau, who was the head of Michigan Bell, and I was on an advisory committee for Michigan Bell talking about financial services and that, and it was always services to the community. And they were asking them to go into not to be Michigan Bell anymore. It was Michigan Bell, Ohio Bell, it was all the Bell systems in the Midwest. And they had become American. And at that time, the five states, had one board, and not representation from Michigan, by the way. So I bought the stock, and I asked my friends, I said, well, we've done everything else. Why don't we have an impact on corporate America as an activist? You know, and they said, Jay, can you do that? And I said, yeah, why not? As long as you buy stock, you're an owner. So we started the corporate responsibility through advocacy, true ownership. That's what it's called. You know, so what I did was bought the stock, buy stocks in each corporation that I thought didn't have representation. Well, for Ameritech, I was fighting for African-American females because they let 4,000 female cell workers go. And you got to remember, these were employees, African-American females, who were never going to be able to make that kind of money again because they had already been most of their careers with Michigan Bell.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Washington, I went to Chicago for the stockholders meeting, and I had just started this corporation called Corporate Responsibility to Advocacy. True ownership. And so I went and got up and spoke about, you know, as you right size, because they said they were right sizing. I looked at it as downsizing. And you were going to downsize, but you were going to impact mostly in Michigan and in Detroit was going to be African American females.
Mm-hmm.
Who never were going to be able to work that get that kind of money again. What was their, you know, what was their future going to look like, and was there going to be a chance for them to come back because they were so experienced with your company? You know, they were very nice because they had answered, you know, the question. Of course, they were going to have 2 years of service pay and blah, 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 blah. You know, that's not an answer. That was just, they were just trying to come up with something. I said, okay, that's not good. So I came back and I talked to some of my African-American, you know, community members, and I said, can you go with me? So the next time I took an African-American leader with me to Chicago, and they got up and spoke about the impact of how it was going to impact on minorities, and specifically African-American females. So I've been doing that since 1989, and I go to corporate America boards and ask, you know, do they have representation of African-Americans, you know, Hispanics, you know, and made some real, real differences, you know. I think it's been a great outcome. I don't pick to choose who goes on their board, but because of 5 or 6 years that I go, they actually do have representation. That's an outcome.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have anything to do with who they pick. I just keep saying, we need representation. We need representation. And you cannot hit diversity, true diversity, until you have someone from my community sitting on that board making decisions. So I went from one extreme to another.
Right.
But it's been very successful, man. We got a Hispanic at DTE. We got a Hispanic at Comerica. We have a Hispanic at GE and General Motors. We've always had a Hispanic at Ford. They were way ahead of the game. But yeah, we've had Hispanics where there wasn't before. And we're very pleased with that.
Mm-hmm. So when you
that's just an outcome.
Right. So when you first started in your activism, was there any one person or group that was really resistant to the changes that you were trying to implement specifically?
If there was any one group that was what?
That was resistant to the changes?
No, whether if it was American GI Forum, or the LULAC organization, you know, SARE, Metro Detroit, or LaSalle, they were always happy to have me, you know. Because sometimes, like you said, people don't want to talk about uncomfortable issues. I never had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were, those organizations, not in my community, all those organizations were very supportive of what I was doing.
That's great.
No, I think that's wonderful. You have great people that are no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lucy Gajak, Skip Alvarado, who started, you know, who worked at the American GI Forum, the veterans. You know, you have all these people that were trailblazers. They were the trailblazers. I was just a voice. And because I didn't have a problem getting up and speaking, they were very supportive.
Okay.
You got to remember, I work for, you know, I'm the chair of the board of the oldest Hispanic organization in the city of Detroit, and that's what I say, Latin Americans for Social and Economic Development. But people don't realize I'm not a paid person. I'm a total volunteer. There's no salary attached to my involvement.
Mm-hmm.
I went to work for the federal government, and I was blessed enough to work more than 27 years for them. And I had a great boss who, anytime I wanted to do something, they were very supportive because I was a community activist. I also was a community worker for the Bureau of the Census to get people to file their forms and things like that. So they were very supportive. So in my life, I've been extremely blessed.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic.
You know, I've been appointed by 3 mayors, you know, to several committees. You know, that's the time I said it's always been, I've had a very blessed life. And it's not been a struggle to get up and say whatever you thought you had to say that was right.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you wanted to hear the truth or not, you know, it was very important, I think, that we needed to voice our opinion. You know, I got up at a New Detroit meeting and challenged the African-Americans saying, you know, hey, we're part of this process. You know, minorities doesn't mean African-American only, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a lot of our community people were, you know, they were uncomfortable saying that. I never was. And maybe it's because I am born and raised in Detroit. You know, maybe that the idea that I was a Hispanic chick born in Southwest Detroit made it very possible. I paid my dues, so I don't have any problems getting up and telling people that I think they've been injustice to certain people. You know, I was interviewed not too long ago, and the person in the interview called in and said that I was an American, and I said absolutely, and they said, well, you know, don't you think that the people that are here illegally should be terminated and sent back to wherever they came from? And I said, no, because I thought that this whole land, this whole country, was built on the backs of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you wash that away? You don't wash it away. You know, you can't wash it away. You know, well, you know, all these aliens. I said, first of all, people are human beings. They're not aliens. Aliens, I was brought up to believe, were from another world. Another planet.
Mm-hmm.
These people are from the same continent.
Yeah.
We just happened to have a border that was landed on them based on 200 years of whatever we did. You know, so you have to educate people that what they say is not accurate, you know. It's like, I've covered the census. I covered 4 censuses from 80 to 2010. In 1990, I had to go to think, you know, and people don't forget that the Upper Peninsula is really part of Michigan, but I went up to it quite a bit, and I never forgot the fact that and this was in 90, we're not talking about, you know, 1960s or 70s or 80s, this was 90, and I never forget it that I sat on a plane, and the lady said to me, excuse me, but can I ask you what you are? And I said, and I offended her when I told her that I was an American. I never forgot the look on her face. She said, can I ask you what you are? And I said, sure. I said, I'm an American. It offended her. You could see it in her face.
Hmm.
And she said, no, I mean, what are you really? And I said, an American. And she said, okay, what heritage are you from? I said, oh, my ethnic background, I'm a Mexican American. But it offended her that I said American first. She said, oh, I'm so glad to hear that you're a Mexican American. I said, oh, really? Why? She said, I thought you were one of those people. And I said, which people are that, ma'am? She said, you know, these people that are fighting for their fishing rights. She was talking about the Native Americans. But because I was dark and I had long hair, you know, she wanted to ask me first if I was Indian, Native American. And I said, no, ma'am, what's the problem? And she said, well, you know, first they want the land, and then they want this, and then they want that, and now they want the fish. And I just looked at her, and I said, oh, my God. And I said, isn't it amazing? I said, we took their land, we took their language, we took their religion, and now we have the nerve that we want to take their fish. The lady couldn't move anywhere. We forgot that. She couldn't move anywhere. It was a 2-seater plane, only 15 passengers. So she had to sit there, and she said, well, I guess you could look at it that way. That's the only way I could look at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was going up there to talk to the chiefs because I handled not only the Hispanic, but also the Native American, the tribal reviews for the Census Bureau. And I'm just amazed that, you know, in this day and age, this, we're talking the 90s, we're talking 27 years ago, that people still thought Native people. And I always wondered why they're, and I have brothers that are half Native. They were born on Montana Reservation. My stepmother was from the Navajo. And I always thought to myself, isn't it amazing that this day and age that people still can think like that? But that's supposed to show you those uncomfortable things that we need to speak about.
Mm-hmm.
And that way we'll always be an activist because you have to fight for those issues. Whatever is wrong is wrong.
Yeah. And so where do you see the Southwest Detroit community heading into the future?
Well, I think we're very fortunate that, and LaSette fought 26 years for, districts. And it wasn't comfortable, trust me, because, you had a lot of African brothers and sisters who said, Jane, you don't need districts as long as your people should run like everybody else. I said, no, I think you need districts. So we always fought for districts. We went on record fighting for districts. And we won that fight with the charter 2 years ago. And now we have a Hispanic representation on the city council. So if you could look at some of that, we've actually made some progress, it's not going to happen overnight because they're going to hit the same problems that everybody else hit. The taxes, the bankruptcy, the lack of resources. But at least we hit it. It may have taken us some time, but we hit it. We have a representation in the city council. And we have access. Mike Duggan, I worked with Mike for many, many years. I was on the board with him at DMC. He's very sensitive to Southwest Detroit based on the fact that his grandfather grew up there. And, and I think that, when you have that sensitivity, you can have enough sense to at least come to the table and think about resources. Southwest Detroit became very important to the rest of the city of Detroit based on the population and the people are stable and that they're still living there. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The neighborhood, if you look at the neighborhood, they have diminished quite a bit. East Side, you can't even find houses there. I got lost one day, and I get lost usually, but I went the wrong way to a meeting. At the end of the week, people were having a meeting, and I went the wrong way. And by the time I hit the river, I was crying because I couldn't believe the massive, vast, empty space of that area, And so now I kind of realized why Southwest Detroit was so important because, you have houses still there. You still have all these people living there. They move, a lot of the Hispanics have moved because of the education, just like I said to you before. But they're moving right along the river, right along the 75, freeway, so that they can come back into the community within 10 minutes. Whether it's Allen Park, Lincoln Park, Allendale, they come back into Detroit because of all the restaurants and all the bakeries. But that's also what's helping keep Detroit stable with those businesses that haven't moved.
Mm-hmm.
The Eastern Market, I'm real happy to see that's coming back on the other side. But it still doesn't have the residential. See, that's what I'm talking about. We have a lot of residential. And that's very important to the community. So, I think Southwest is a very important part of the city. And I think it's finally been recognized as a very part of the city.
All right, so one of the last questions I have here, are there any changes that you still would like to see implemented in your community?
Oh, I would still like to see, if they pass the DREAM Act tomorrow, next Tuesday, and they look like they're going to pass it, it's going to make it easier for people to get driver's license. It's very, very difficult to have people that are immigrants and that are not here legally, or they're not documented well, they can't get a driver's license. You really don't want people out there with no driver's license. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever wisdom that was used across the country, they decided to call that if you can't have a social security number, it's almost like tracking people. If you can't have a social security number, you can't get a driver's license. And that's been a big issue. You have people driving in Southwest Detroit that don't have driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they're Hispanic or African-Americans or any other nationality, they didn't even have a driver's license.
Yeah.
So those are the big issues that, but of course, it impacts more on us. The social services issues have been real big in the last several months because, for whatever wisdom, the state of Michigan has decided that they're going to do less services at the stop at the and for the social services. You know, whether you get your My Card or where you get the food stamp or whether you get, you know, any kind of health services, you have to go online to get these services. Well, not everybody has a computer, so we're dealing with, you know, people coming in at La Fe because they don't have access. Not everybody has internet. Not everybody has computers. And then on top of that, the person, the head of household, has to have a social security card. Well, a lot of the undocumented children are, their parents are undocumented, but the children are American citizens. So those are the issues we're fighting right now that are a real impact. You want children to have food, you want them to have medical services, and because their parents aren't legally here, they may not, they are legally entitled to them, but the parents don't know how, where to go. So, you know, we're getting bombarded with a lot of that stuff, and we're hoping that the state will turn around and, like the IRS takes the PIN number. They're assigned a PIN number so they can pay their taxes. We're hoping that the Department of Social Services will also accept the PIN number. So that children can have, access to services.
Mm-hmm.
Those are our issues right now, and those are bread and butter issues. You know, they're not like, you know, can we vote tomorrow? We're talking about bread and butter just to feed the children.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, here we are, 40, 50 years later, and we're still pretty much in the same kind of boat. In a lot of communities, I'm not saying all communities, in a lot of communities.
What do you think are some of the steps towards...
I beg your pardon?
What do you think are some of the steps that need to be taken towards making those changes?
Well, I think obviously sensitizing the state of Michigan and making sure that children have access, and we're meeting. We're already starting to meet with them and saying, you know, this is not acceptable. You know, it doesn't matter how you feel about the parents, and we don't know what the immigration issues are going to become. We don't know who's going to become legal and who's going to be accessed to legal. We don't know that. But children still need to have services. So we've already put it in writing to the governor, and now we're meeting with the people at the state to see, you know, and heading up the programs to see where they can make some changes. And they really need to have bilingual services across the board so that people can explain to them what their rights are.
Yeah, that's important.
That's very important.
All right. My last question is, what was the impact of the Detroit bankruptcy on the community?
I don't think it impacted that much on our community. The impact, you know, the businesses still pay their taxes. You know, I don't think it impacted on us because there wasn't a whole lot of contracts there. They were owed to the Hispanic contractors, trust me. So it didn't impact the same. You just had the repercussion of how it affected the city that was going to affect us. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people still have to pay their taxes. Doesn't matter whether we're in bankruptcy or not. I mean, you know, just because you're in bankruptcy doesn't mean you don't have to pay your taxes. And you still have to pay the parking tickets. I mean, so you still have to... You know, bankruptcy affected large corporations that were owed money. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Vendors. The bankruptcy affected them more than it affected, you know, people that live in certain areas. You know, don't forget, we weren't already not getting a lot of services,
mm-hmm.
You know? So it didn't affect us the same. We're hoping that coming out of bankruptcy, they'll find solutions to helping the businesses stay in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the last 2 years, I've seen a lot of businesses close down because they just couldn't pay their taxes anymore. They couldn't pay, you know, they couldn't make enough money to pay their taxes. So I'm hoping that coming out of bankruptcy, there's some leniency for the corporations, for the restaurants and the businesses that decided to stay. That no matter what, they're still there.
Mm-hmm.
We have some businesses that are paying us $20,000 a year in taxes. And the man that closed his business right before the holidays, the last year, the Easter, no, it was Cinco de Mayo, because I was at home working with Cinco de Mayo. I remember he was closing. He'd been in business 25 years. He just didn't make enough money to pay his taxes.
Yeah, and that's really unfortunate when, you know, institutions like that are forced to close.
And he was in the community right on Michigan Avenue, Michigan Avenue and Central, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
He had to close. And that's a business that's gone forever, you know. And, you know, so I'm hoping coming out of bankruptcy that the solution will be to help these people that want to stay in business. Whether we give them 5 years of a waiver for half their taxes, that would be great. That would really be great for these people because they struggle. I've heard a lot of them say, you know, the restaurants, they say, you know, our taxes are so high that we may just, you know, close. And, you know, that would be devastating for our community in Southwest Detroit. That's one of my biggest fears, and I'm hoping that after bankruptcy, we can sit down and talk about some waivers for these people.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's 50% waiver, just to keep them here.
Yeah.
Because if you go down, have you been to Southwest Detroit?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you got to go. Go down Vernon. We're at La Fe is right on the corner of Vernon and Scotton, and across the street from Big Park, which is very old. And then you have Armando's Taco House, and then you have Mexican Town Bakery, and it's very viable. You go down Burner all the way down to Springwalls, there's businesses. They're still there. They're still vibrant, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we're grateful for them.
Yeah.
Right on Bagby, it's only 2 or 3 blocks of pure restaurants. But they do well.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because of our Canadian brothers is what I noticed when I went to But you know what? By any means necessary. You know, that's what I say. By any means necessary, you know?
Yeah. A lot of my family immigrated into Canada.
You should really do that. Go to the bakeries. They're really great bakeries.
Mm-hmm.
Really great.
Yeah.
And I was growing up, I had a lot of Polish bakeries on Michigan Avenue. They're all gone.
Mm.
See, I don't want that to happen to our community. All the Polish bakeries that were down Michigan Avenue and Livernois, they're all gone. There isn't one Polish bakery left. And I grew up with all of them there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want that to happen in my community. I don't want that to happen, you know, in our community. That the bakeries do the taxes, outdo them, and they just leave. Or they go downriver, because I've seen a lot of restaurants, Mexican restaurants, open up down Lincoln Park, Melvindale, Allen Park. I've never seen so many, but I think it was the tax. That's why they opened up over there and not in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've seen. I've seen those kind of changes.
All right.
Like
well,
every community, we have our good and our bad. So we still have to deal with the gangs that we didn't used to deal with years ago. And you know, we have agencies that are dealing with them and trying to get them in school and keep them in school. But, you know, like everybody else, you know, you have your problems with some of the gang stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Jane, for taking the time to talk with me about this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I hope you found it enjoyable. I mean, you try to wrap up 50 years and something, and I'm not sure. You know, I've been married 51 years. And
oh, congrats.
I know. Isn't it amazing? I look at the only reason I know I've been married that long is I see my children. But, you know, I've been very fortunate to have a great community that supported me so many years. And I think that I supported them has been a real joy. Because if you bring about some little, even if it's just a little bit of change, it's important.
Mm-hmm.